This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, both Republicans and Democrats in the U.S. claim it's all right to threaten Venezuela with invasion because it's not a democracy. But we'll talk with a veteran Black activist who was an official observer of democracy in action in Venezuela. And a call for the abolition of poverty by getting rid of the class that is hoarding all the wealth. But first, Angela Davis, the human rights activist, was initially disinvited from an event of the Civil Rights Institute in Birmingham, Alabama, Davis's hometown, apparently because of her support for Palestinian rights. The month before, CNN fired Mark Lamont Hill for supporting Palestinians in a speech at the United Nations. We spoke with Michael Fischbach, a professor of history at Randolph-Macon College and author of a new book titled Black Power and Palestine. Fischbach says Black American empathy with Palestinians and Arabs is nothing new.
I found from my research that recent examples of Black support for the Palestinians, in fact, rest on some pretty solid bases that go back a number of decades. I focused basically on the 1960s and 70s in my book, but one could even look at examples back into the late 1940s, particularly in the Nation of Islam, of people who, Americans of African descent, who saw in the Palestinians not just allies, but really fellow peoples of color that were struggling much as they were. And most famously, in the 60s, that kind of worldview was articulated first by people like Malcolm X, later by groups like SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and groups like the Black Panthers, who saw Black Americans, really, many of them explained it as a colony within the United States that was waging a struggle for liberation, much as the Palestinians and other people in the so-called Third World were doing. And therefore, they saw their struggle as not just intimately tied up with the Palestinians, but some went so far as to say, if the Palestinians can't be free, neither can we. So fast forward to today, when you get, for example, in Ferguson, Missouri, during the disturbances there, well, not just Ferguson, but other places, you had Palestinians in the West Bank tweeting to protesters in places like Ferguson saying, you know, here's how we deal with security forces firing tear gas at us here in the West Bank, because we deal with the Israeli security forces all the time. One young man sent a tweet with a picture of himself holding a sign saying, we Palestinians know what it's like to be shot dead because of your ethnicity. And there was an exchange. Palestinian students visited Ferguson. Ferguson students and others, including Patricia Cullors and others from Dream Defenders, from Black Lives Matter, went to the West Bank. So when you see these kinds of examples of solidarity, of people saying, look, we are people of color, we're fighting to be free, we're being targeted because of our ethnicity, my book explores how those kind of sentiments really are anchored on a deep history that goes back 5 decades.
And in fact, since Ferguson, Israel has become even more restrictive on folks coming into the country. It does background checks, and if they seem politically hostile to the Zionist project, they don't get in.
Yes, in recent years, people from all backgrounds, including American Jews, have been denied entry. At the same time, of course, that Israel, like many countries in Europe and the United States, has also seen a lot of public vitriol against immigrants, legal and otherwise, who have been trying to come in. There's a lot of discussion going on in Israel about Eritreans, South Sudanese, other African migrants who have entered Israel seeking asylum, seeking work, seeking safety. So it's not necessarily a coincidence that at the same time that that's going on, and at the same time that there literally is a wall, people talk about President Donald Trump saying build a wall. I mean, Israel has built a wall between it and the West Bank. Not surprising that at the same time you see that siege mentality extending to people trying to come in to Israel and the West Bank who are activists and being turned away at the border.
It should be said that even before the rise of the Nation of Islam, there were Moorish societies in Black America all over the place, and that until very recently, a majority of Muslims in the United States were Black Americans.
Yes, American Black identification with Arabs in the Middle East, as you rightly pointed out, goes back quite a long time. We have, for example, slave memoirs were written in Arabic. So the connection between Americans of color, notably Black Americans, and the Middle East and Arabs and Muslims does indeed go way back. You correctly pointed out the Moorish temple science, the Nation of Islam, people who said that, you know, we are by blood related to the Arabs, or the Nation of Islam used the term Asiatic. We are Asiatic. We are related to those people. And Malcolm X once noted that after visiting the Middle East, he said, you know, it's fair to say that 99% of Arabs would be Jim Crowed if they came here to the United States, that, you know, we look the same, we're part of the same people. And I think the religious connection, as well as the general among Americans who are Muslim, whether the Nation of Islam or, let's say, more conventional Islam, as well as this ideological connection that emerged in the 60s of a common struggle, definitely bound those two areas together in a sense of transnational identity.
And of course, in the 1960s, there was a resurgence of internationalism in Black America, which was viewed with deep anxiety among many Zionist circles in the United States.
Yes, one of the, of course, most famous at the time until about the 1967 war in the Middle East, examples of that were when SNCC came out against the war in Vietnam in 1966, fairly early in 1966, and began losing support, losing financial contributions, and within the Black community, more mainstream civil rights groups saying, you know, you should stick to, you know, racial issues, this is what we're about. And SNCC, following on the internationalism of people like Malcolm X, said, no, we're more than this. In fact, in 1967, SNCC stated that we are now a human rights group. We're not simply a group dealing with American racial issues. And then, of course, Martin Luther King Jr. came out in April of 67 against the war in Vietnam, similarly to great opprobrium. So Black Americans were very keen observers of events going on in the world, in Vietnam, in decolonization in Africa and Asia. And at times in, you know, reminiscent of things going on today, as you mentioned at the beginning of your program, sometimes face a great backlash for speaking out on those global issues.
During the Free South Africa campaign in the 1980s, it became well known that Israel and South Africa had a strategic relationship, which further contributed to Black American opposition to Israel's foreign policies and its domestic policies.
That's true. That's very true. And in fact, extended back even until the 60s, when SNCC issued its famous newsletter article in August 1967, blasting Israel and hailing the Palestinian struggle, and received so much abuse and opprobrium for that newsletter article. That was one of the first examples I think many people, especially supporters of Israel, saw Black Americans daring to challenge Israel. That very newsletter article mentioned, you know, Israel's ties with South Africa, with what was then known as Rhodesia. In December 1970, a group called Black Americans for Truth About the Middle East published a large ad, a full-page ad in the New York Times, which was responding to a pro-Israeli ad in the Times that had been published 6 months earlier by the likes of Baird Rustin. And in this December 1970 statement in the New York Times denouncing Israel and calling for, you know, Americans not to support Israel, they again mentioned Israel's support, mutual support between Israel and South Africa. And the group that same year, 1970, the group, the American Committee on Africa, there was an internal dispute where many of the staff members of the American Committee on Africa, who were themselves younger and black, were saying, you know, we're a group that basically was started to support the South African freedom struggle. The group got started in the 50s, and yet we're saying nothing about the close ties between Israel and South Africa. So, yes, that connection that many Americans of African descent drew in the 80s, it too had older roots. As black Americans said, look, you know, sometimes America's allies like Israel are on the wrong side of history when it comes to questions near and dear to our hearts.
And people took note in the 1970s when Andrew Young, Jimmy Carter's ambassador to the United Nations, became involved in talks with the Palestinians and was subsequently fired.
Yes, and in fact, the first thing that went through my mind when hearing about the controversy regarding Mark Lamont Hill in December was that. Well, here's the Andrew Young affair all over again. Young was the United States ambassador to the United Nations. He was the highest-ranking black American in the Carter administration. He was the first black to occupy the position of UN ambassador. And in service to American diplomatic goals, he felt obliged secretly to meet with the PLO's ambassador to the United Nations, a man named Zahedi Terzi, in order to block the UN Security Council discussing something that would have called for a Palestinian state. So he did this very much in service of American ideals. But according to a 1975 agreement that then Secretary of State Henry Kissinger had made to Israel, the United States was to have no tie, no connection, no nothing with the PLO. And so Carter fired him. And then it came out a few days later that the American ambassador to Austria, a man named Milton Wolf, had in fact himself three times met with PLO officials secretly in Europe, and nothing happened to him. So black Americans of all stripes, from more militant ones, black power was really on the wane by 1979, down to more conservative civil rights leaders, were furious at this not only unequal treatment, comparing what happened to Wolf with what happened to Andrew Young, but they also felt that it was a patronizing effort by well-educated white elites to say that, look, blacks can speak out on the issues of the day if they relate to race, but not if they relate to foreign policy. And there was a huge brouhaha that led to both Jesse Jackson and Joseph Lowery traveling to the Middle East, meeting with Yasser Arafat, head of the PLO, and it really galvanized a lot of issues that motivated blacks feeling they had a right to speak out on the great issues of the day, whether it was the Middle East or something else.
Today, supporters of Israel get livid whenever the word apartheid and Israel are mentioned in the same breath.
Yes, I think one of the most famous examples of that, speaking of Jimmy Carter, occurred just a few years ago after Carter published a book dealing with the Arab-Israeli conflict that said peace and not apartheid. He took so much grief that he actually later apologized for using the term. You know, here's the former president of the United States feeling backed into a corner enough that he felt he had to apologize for using that connection. Of course, people who have made the connection say that in terms of carrying ID cards, in terms of security forces, in terms of no-go zones, of fences, and the like, said that both Israel and the way it deals with Palestinians, both in the occupied territory and within Israel itself, is an ethnic-based identity system. So they have very much held up the similarities, but the differences and the fact that the word has such a ring to it, and I think, frankly, the fact that many strong supporters of Israel felt nervous about any kind of moral comparison between the apartheid system and what's going on with the Palestinians, that really enraged them. And I think in many ways that same sense of fury goes on today vis-a-vis the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, which was used successfully in the South African case. I think some of the outrage by strongly pro-Israeli people against BDS, beyond anything else they may object to it, I think it's this idea that it's, you don't want that moral equivalency. You know, Israel is like South Africa. And therefore, by extension, those fighting South Africa and those fighting Israel somehow have international right on their side.
Yes, it states across the country and in the national legislature of the United States, there are laws that have been passed that would restrict or outlaw folks who support BDS. And those laws fly in the face of court precedents that are based on black boycotts here in this country against racist businesses.
Yes, and in fact, especially here in the South, I live in Virginia, I teach at a college in Virginia, I mean, I have actually said that when officials, legislators, governors or whatever, particularly in southern states, enact laws that seek to punish people for boycotting anything, I mean, Israel happens to be the subject du jour, but boycotting anything, that it's very much reminiscent of a very ugly period of time when people seeking to preserve racial supremacy in the South sought to criminalize what ironically is a very peaceful form of protest. In the late 1960s, California Governor Ronald Reagan famously said that Cesar Chavez and the great boycott from the United Farm Workers was, quote, terribly immoral, without really explaining what was immoral about a non-violent form of protest. So I think people, and even there are some Democratic candidates for president, such as Bernie Sanders, who would say, look, regardless of whether you think boycotting Israel is or isn't a good thing, the act of boycotting itself surely falls within the realm of free speech movement. And I think on a wider level, it is kind of ironic that people who are strong supporters of Israel have criticized Palestinians quite sharply over the years for armed struggle, for the use of violence in their struggle against Israel, and then find it supremely ironic that starting in 2005, when they have urged, the Palestinians have urged their supporters around the world to take up a nonviolent form of resistance, that is boycotts and divestments, that they similarly are criticized. I mean, one is left saying, well, what form of protest, what form of struggle are you going to find acceptable for the Palestinians?
Or for their supporters around the world, those who support Palestinian rights.
Indeed, and my personal opinion, once again, is regardless of whether one thinks that boycotting Israel is or isn't a good thing, or isn't reflective of one's own politics, again, the idea, I think, that so many people for so many decades called on the Palestinians to cease violence and acts of violence and terrorism and pursue a nonviolent struggle, well, lo and behold, here's what they've chosen. So again, putting aside even for a moment the question of whether one supports Israel, the idea that people are engaged in a nonviolent form of resistance, I think in any part of the world on any issue is a welcome thing that should be embraced. But of course, most anything to do in this country having to do with Israel is always very, very controversial. And we're going to see that in the upcoming presidential elections, where once again, that will be the one thing that both the Democrat and the Republican candidate will agree on is, you know, strong support for Israel.
In this ongoing debate about blacks and Palestine and Israel, the Israel lobby often puts forth Martin Luther King as being on the Israeli side of this debate.
Well, you know, my research showed that King's position on the Arab-Israeli conflict was actually more nuanced than that. And you're right that, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. is political goal, is political capital. Everybody wants a piece of King. And various people have always suggested, well, what would King think about this issue, that issue? The Arab-Israeli is no exception. Indeed, in the last 10 years or so, there has been an article that has often been cited about King. He allegedly wrote, called Letter to an Anti-Zionist Friend, equating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, that has turned out to be a hoax. Even strongly pro-Israeli groups have conceded that he never wrote this. The article, the page numbers, the journal that allegedly it appeared in, people have checked, it didn't exist. So, you know, who came up with this hoax, we're not sure. But the reality is that Martin Luther King Jr. really understood Palestinian grievances. He traveled to Jerusalem and the West Bank in 1959. My research showed a story that no one's ever read before, which is that King became ill in Jerusalem. He was treated by a doctor who, while actually ethnically Armenian, was Arabic speaker, grew up all his life in Jerusalem, and was a refugee, like hundreds of thousands of other Palestinians in the 1948 war. And he told me, the doctor told me, he said, King, when I finished treating him, King said, please sit down, we'd like to talk. And the doctor said, okay. And King said, we'd like to hear the Arab point of view. All we hear is the Israeli point of view. And this is 1959. So he told him, he talked to him. The doctor later arranged for a dinner with dignitaries from East Jerusalem. And King, in fact, made a speech, delivered a sermon, a walk through the Holy Land 2 weeks later back at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. So by the 1960s, and after Israel launched the 67 war and occupied Christian holy sites in the West Bank, King was actually planning a pilgrimage to the area that he called off, because he didn't want to enter that thicket. He didn't want to seem to be supportive of Israel's action. He was getting flack from black power advocates for his stance. And so King basically, in the remaining months of his life, came up with a certain position. When asked about the issue, he would always say, Israel has a right to exist, period, full stop. He never talked about Israel's actions, but he said, Israel has a right to exist. However, peace will not come to the Middle East until the Arab world can be moved out of poverty. He said, just like our inner cities, poverty breeds frustration, explosions of violence. So he never came out publicly and said he understood or supported the political grievances of the Palestinians, which he clearly understood. But the most he would say is, we need to solve poverty. But, you know, indeed, for that, he still went out of his way to always link the two. Yes, I support Israel's right to exist. However, we have to deal with poverty in the Arab world. We have to address that issue for Palestinians and other Arabs if there ever going to be peace in the Middle East. So, yes, he supported Israel, but again, it was a much more nuanced position. King was clearly very aware, and Jesse Jackson later wrote that before he died, King said the Palestinians is going to be the next big issue the world has to deal with.
That was Professor Michael Fischbach, author of the book Black Power and Palestine. The South American nation of Venezuela has held more elections in the past 20 years than any other nation in the hemisphere, and maybe the entire world. But the corporate media in both political parties in the U.S. insist that Venezuela's socialist government is a dictatorship. President Trump has seized billions in Venezuelan assets and is threatening military action. In Greenville, South Carolina, Ifeo Wangaza is a people's lawyer and director of the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination. Wangaza was among the international observers that have verified all of Venezuela's elections as free and fair.
Not only do I take this position, but former president, U.S. President Jimmy Carter, also takes the position that Venezuela has the most transparent and cleanest elections of any country in the world. So much so that the Carter Center almost doesn't even bother about going anymore because that description has not changed. When I participated as in the observer delegation last May, which happened to be Malcolm X's birthday weekend, I was utterly amazed at the transparency, the access, and the certification process. We know that the first thing that we experienced was the opportunity to examine the hardware. The hardware was designed in collaboration with Venezuelan engineers and Chinese manufacturers. The software was the same thing. They showed us exactly, piece by piece, how it worked. When we go looking at the software has internal safety measures and checks and has a verification process that any citizen can walk off the street in his or her polling place and demand not only an audit, but also demand an examination and certification of the software as his or her vote is being processed, ballot is being processed. I want to go to access. In this country, we know voter suppression is an industry in and of itself. In Venezuela, it's just the opposite. The government takes every effort to make sure that folk are able to vote. In fact, when someone turns 18 years old, they are automatically registered and eligible to vote. And that, I would point out, is without regard for one's, for lack of a better term, criminal punishment status. Further, all candidates have an equal amount of free time on media, television, radio. Print is different because print is privately owned. All campaigning on that level ends 2 weeks before the election. So we have voters having ready automatic access to the polls, the franchise. We have candidates having full, unfettered, uncostly, free access to the public through the media. And on the day of the election itself, there are polling places everywhere. The only place that I saw a line to vote was on the military bases. In the neighborhoods, people come in, they identify themselves, everyone has their identity card, they present their identity card, the first machine has their thumbprint, which is electronically attached to their identity card, and a picture of them and their identity card appears in response to their thumbprint. So it's very clear that the person who is voting is the person who is supposed to be voting. They go from that station to the next station where essentially the same process occurs and they sign themselves into the polling place. They go from that station to the ballot itself, which is a combination of pictures and lettered narrative. And it really reminded me very much of our voting literacy program in the South during the 60s, especially in Lowndes County, where the Black Panther was used as the symbol to not only to embody the spirit of the campaign, but also to overcome the high illiteracy rate of the community with which we were dealing. So you have that same kind of concern and solution in Venezuela. Once the ballot has been marked, and here the people actually, they vote for the party, as opposed to voting for the individual. But once they have cast their ballot, then the ballot prints out a receipt, just like you get at an ATM machine. Then that receipt is compared with, you can compare it with what your recollection is of how you voted and whether or not it's reflected in the process as represented by the receipt. Here in South Carolina, we have a paperless system where even elected officials have objected to having cast a vote, chosen a candidate, and another candidate's name come up. This has gone on for at least the past 20 years without change. And now the Republican administration, and it's not limited, frankly, to the Republicans or the Democrats, because the Democrats are no better, had said, okay, we're going to change the machines because they're old, they're malfunctioning, and we need the money to change the system with a paper ballot, to have a paper, at least a receipt, so that we can go back and look. See if it's for consistency. Now, last week, they've announced that they can't do that because they don't have enough money to do that, but they're so concerned about democracy, right? In Venezuela, at the end of the day, the managers and the polling managers must take a tally of the signatures. They must take a tally of the thumb imprints. They must take a tally of the ballots themselves. They must take a tally of the outcome of the ballots. All of this is done in full public view. You can stand there right beside the poll managers and watch everything they do, not from across the room, right beside them. All of those tallies must match. If they do not match, they have to go through the process all over again. And any citizen in that polling place can say, I don't like what that looks like. I want to see this section of it, or I want to see the whole thing. And it has to be redone. Now, in the United States, you can't even get to where they tally the votes, assuming that there's even a paper ballot, or in Philadelphia, where I used to live, they had the lever, so there was nothing again. At the end of the evening, all of this information is both transmitted electronically to the Election Commission headquarters, and all the paperwork is taken to the Electoral Commission. At that time, there is a comparison, and again, the tallies must match. After that process is completed, then the members of the Election Commission comes into a public forum and announces what the outcome of the election is. And if folks go to my Facebook page, they'll see me standing in that room with the outcome of the election on the screen behind me, where Maduro won by almost 2-1. Now, it has to be pointed out that the United States, in its continuous meddling in other people's elections, had told the opposition to boycott, while the segment of the opposition most heavily under U.S. control did in fact boycott. It was estimated that even if they had participated, they would not have gotten more than 40% of the vote. Of the opposition that did participate, they got even less. I think they got roughly around 15-20%. But you can see the graph. So the notion that Maduro was not elected is totally bogus. And we see the United States going into its regular pattern of first vilification for the purposes of discounting the leadership that the people choose, and then imposing sanctions for destabilization and thirdly, to present its own candidate for office. We saw that when they tried to overthrow Chavez before. We saw it in Chile when they killed Allende. We saw it in Iran. We've seen it repeatedly, and we must stand up and speak out against it and speak in support of the Venezuelan democracy, its sovereignty, and the integrity of its constitution.
As a Black American, I'm sure you were highly cognizant of the demographics that supported the socialist government and those that opposed it.
Absolutely. We went into neighborhoods where, first of all, under Chavez, more than 2 million public housing units were built. You have, even as we speak, we have China, we have Russia, we have Iran, that in Venezuela building even more public housing, while in the United States, public housing is being destroyed, decimated, demolished. And the numbers of homelessness in the United States ratcheting up exponentially. So, to put it simply, it is the Afro-Venezuelans, who are significant in numbers. You know, we think that we're only in the United States and Africa, but the largest population outside of the United States is in South America. It's Brazil, of course, but Venezuela is close behind. So when we get a chance to see the demonstrations, the pro-government demonstrations are Black people and brown people, indigenous people, as compared with the demonstrations against the government, which are the white folks, who think that they are going to get back into power as a result of U.S. control of the resources that they will give over to the United States business community, as every element of the U.S., from Trump on down to that criminal, convicted war criminal, Elliot Abrams, the oil of the Venezuelan people. The Venezuelan people have sworn to not only protect their constitution, but protect that resource. I would also point out that in every country that the United States invades, it has been a country that has not only had resources, but despite whatever corruption and squander there may have been, have also used the resources to benefit the people, where they've had free to low-cost housing, free to low-cost education, health care, and quality of life, whether you're talking about Iraq, Iran, Libya, and now Venezuela. It's time that we stand with the people of the world, especially us as Black people, reclaim our moral center and our moral authority as the voice of equity in this country. Now, we know that when the United States decided to invade Iraq, the outcry here and around the world was disregarded. But that is not a reason to not stand up.
Yes, the Congressional Black Caucus does not seem even to acknowledge that the Afro-Venezuelans exist, and neither does the great Black Democratic hope, Kamala Harris.
Kamala Harris has been so committed to the status quo, to the rule of white supremacist racist law in this country, as represented by her position as district attorney in San Francisco and state attorney for California, there is no reason to expect anything different from her. Kamala Harris is a parasitic opportunist who, like Barack Obama, is a Trojan horse coming into the Black community and other communities of color, using the emotional heartstrings as a gateway to the White House and the retention of white power in the hands of, if not actual white males, white male surrogates.
How is it that this received wisdom that the Venezuelan process is unfair and that the socialist government is corrupt, how is that accepted by virtually all of the mainstream politicians, despite the lack of any evidence?
I'm more concerned about it being accepted by the masses of the people, and that is that, as the Nazi propagandist put it, if you tell a lie often enough, then the people will believe it. And the election of Donald Trump shows that in modern times that observation is as true now as it was then. And given that the electoral class in this country is committed, one, to capitalism and their individual personal aggrandizement and enrichment, that they are desirous of, even though they know better, of maintaining their positions of comfort and ease, even if it's at the expense of the masses of the people and, as they put it, our democracy.
There is no discussion in the current furor over Venezuela of international law. The subject doesn't even come up in the United States.
And that's further evidence of how little respect that the United States on all levels and all sectors have for law generally. We know that the law is nothing more than the codification of the will of those with the gun. It is a matter of coercion. It is a matter of might making right without regard for ethics or morality.
There's not much of an anti-war movement in the United States, but what there is of it is mobilizing behind the threats to Venezuela.
We know that there is a U.S. delegation that will be going to Venezuela in the coming days in order to gather information and to report back. It is important that they get as great an airing as possible, number one. And number two, that there is a mass demonstration scheduled for the month of March, and people ought to be on the lookout for the notices and information and to participate in that march and the expressions of outrage that's necessary to at least inform the rest of the world and the people of Venezuela that there is support in the United States for them and for right.
That was Ifeo Wangaza of the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination in Greenville, South Carolina. The popular backlash against deepening economic inequality gets more intense by the day. William Anderson is co-author of a book titled As Black as Resistance, Finding Conditions for Liberation. In an article in Truth Out, Anderson said it's time to heed Dr. Martin Luther King's call for the abolition of poverty.
Abolition pretty much sums up the feelings of people like myself who are quite done with the idea of trying to reform what was never supposed to work for us to begin with. Simply put, there's a lot of the things that need to be abolished, whether we're talking about the prison system, whether we're talking about policing, or whether we're talking about the construct of whiteness and white supremacy. There's plenty to abolish, and abolitionists are tired of trying to reform institutions that are meant to oppress us and that are correctly doing their job.
Poverty is part of a system, and this system does have people at the top who are in control. So if you're talking about abolishing poverty, you're talking about abolishing these classes of folks who create and sustain poverty.
Right. That's one of the things that I tried to touch on in the piece, is that this whole concept that some people deserve to have wealth and that some people deserve to have all of these resources that they've hoarded because they worked hard. I've said before that really the hard work of accumulating that much capital and becoming a billionaire is called exploitation. That is the hard work of being astronomically wealthy. There is no, oh, you earned $1 billion. You got there through some sort of exploitation. It's just not possible under the system of racial capitalism to get to that point where you have accumulated that much through hard work. It's just kind of asinine to think that that's how it works. But unfortunately, people buy into the mythology and the fairy tales that the elite tell them that if they work hard, that they can get there. So unfortunately, a lot of people seek to attain that sort of wealth rather than overthrow it because they think that maybe one day they'll be lucky enough to be in that position if they work hard enough. But most people are never going to achieve that sort of wealth, and they don't realize that the system is actually working correctly to keep them in the position that they're in and exploit them and their labor.
Yeah, well, let's talk about this elite. And that's an easy thing to do because there are fewer and fewer of them at the top with more and more. Jeff Bezos is the richest man in the world. He's one of the three people who own more wealth than half of the population of the United States. And he owns Amazon. And in terms of people working, Amazon workers think their place of work is infamous for working people damn near to death.
The thing that always kind of blows my mind about these increasingly wealthy capitalists who maintain and control so much is how they constantly find ways to extract even more. And the way that people are constantly held in this chokehold by the ways that they're constantly extracting more. And it's getting worse and worse. And I often wonder, and this is what I was talking about, you know, what blows my mind. I often wonder, why aren't people seeking to get rid of this? Why are a lot of people okay with this? Or why are a lot of people excusing this? And I know that there are plenty of people who aren't okay with it, but there just maybe isn't the political education or the consciousness needed to feel that there's something that they can do yet. And I think that that, again, is where we have to come in and really start having conversations and doing work in our communities around political education and explaining to people that there is more, that this isn't the only option. People really buy into this idea that they're living in the greatest country in the world, and that they have the best system, and that they're the most free. And that is where propaganda and, again, the mythology that the state puts out there, that's where that comes in. So much of the work that we have to do to make sure that there are not people like Jeff Bezos, like who can sit there and control so much wealth, the work that we have to do to make sure that there isn't that sort of inequality is really a lot, has so much to do with debunking the myths that people have been fed about someone like him.
In your Truth Out article, you reference both Dr. Martin Luther King and the Black Panther Party. And when folks look back at the 1960s, there's lots of discussion about the differences between Dr. King and the Black Panthers. But the similarity certainly is that both the Panthers and Dr. King were socialists.
Right. There is a lot of misunderstanding about the Panthers and what they represent. And I think that it becomes pretty apparent when you listen to people have conversations and they kind of represent things in this false binary, which is, you know, violent versus nonviolent. When both King and the Panthers were actively practicing and engaging ideas around self-defense, Dr. King was not just out here vulnerable, getting beat up all the time and taking risks without having people around him who are talking about self-defense, without him trying to, you know, get his gun permit himself. Like, King was actively thinking about self-defense the same way that the Panthers talk about self-defense. And there were many similarities there that people just simply don't know about. It's unfortunate that it's painted as one versus the other, whether it's Malcolm X, his legacy, or whether it's King's legacy or the Black Panthers, and many of the people in the civil rights movement, like Fannie Lou Hamer and countless others, Ida B. Wells, talk about self-defense and the importance of it, but that legacy gets kind of co-opted and swept under the rug. I actually wrote a piece before about how the state has really kind of co-opted King Day and made it into a day of service and made it into something that is really supposed to be about some sort of patriotism. When King was critiquing the society and everything that it represents and everything that it does in a way that's so powerful, it's really ridiculous that the state has been able to co-opt it and turn it into something to reinforce itself, to make King this patriotic figure when King was critiquing and damning a lot of the things that this society represents, rather than simply worshiping it and portraying it as something it's not, you know? So there's a lot of complexities about King and the Panthers and what the work that we all want to achieve as activists in this country and as people who want to change this society, what it represents in reality as opposed to what it's made out to be by people who don't want us to know the true message of it.
But in terms of Dr. King's socialism and the Black Panthers' socialism, that connection really is not strange at all. Dr. Michael Dawson, the noted Black social demographer, believes that most Black folks' politics bring them to a kind of at least Swedish social democratic socialism anyway.
I think that a lot of people are closer than we might imagine. That's true. It's very interesting to see the way that the Medicare for All conversation and the push has been happening, and to see people becoming increasingly demanding around healthcare. I think that that's definitely a sign that people are becoming increasingly fed up and realizing that it can be better than this. And again, so much of this goes back to political education. I don't really call myself anything. You know, I don't call myself a socialist. And, you know, I think a lot of people would consider me an anarchist because of my writing and my association. But really, I think that my main focus is just anti-capitalism and abolition at this point, because I feel like a lot of times we can get caught up in sectarianism. I've had that happen a lot on the left.
There's a lot of talk out there these days about a universal basic income. And lots of that talk is coming from the billionaires, especially from Silicon Valley themselves. Why are billionaires talking about universal basic income?
There's a lot of people who have gotten involved in, again, fights like Medicare for All or the fight for 15, which isn't even enough with the $15 minimum wage. And there's just movements happening that are increasing around people wanting more. And so what this capitalist class is doing, with this elite class that can control so much of the wealth in this country, is doing is they're getting ahead the frustration and the resentment that's building, and trying to be able to control the process and dole out the change rather than have to suffer from any consequences of uprising. It's not far-fetched to think or to understand that the capitalists know that people are eventually going to say, this is not okay, and want to overthrow this system. But what they do is they try to get ahead of that and to try to kind of finesse people into being more accepting of it by being able to control the process of any sort of symbolic or minor changes that can maybe hold that overthrow off. I really hope that everyone who is seeing the word abolition and who is entertaining ideas around abolition and thinking about it, I really hope that people understand and feel that this system, this capitalist system that we are living under, and these conditions that we're living under, are absolutely unacceptable. There is nothing about this society that is acceptable. These astronomical amounts of wealth that are being hoarded by the people at the top are not acceptable. We have to be thinking about abolishing rather than reforming. This system is working as it's intended to work, whether we're thinking about the prison system, again, you know, policing, the criminal justice system as a whole, whether we're thinking about capitalism and the way that people are at the bottom and being exploited constantly, well, no matter what it is, these things need to be abolished. It doesn't need to be fixed because it's working the way that it's intended to work. And so that's what really we're talking about when we talk about abolition. We're not feeding into this idea that these things could be reformed. That's why a lot of things aren't changing quickly enough. It's because there's this language around reform that people get caught up in, and it's just not feasible. Like, it's not something that we can entertain for the rest of our lives. We need to be thinking about abolition because we can make and create a world that is much better than the one that we have.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.